This is Rebecca Jernigan, your tour guide into discoveries, coming to you live simulcast from the heart of America to around the globe via the World Wide Web, terrestrial radio, satellite, and podcast. Let's journey together into the realms of the unknown to the known in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. All right, I am here in the studio in the heart of America, Kansas City, broadcasting live and heard on the Journeys with Rebecca Radio Network and all of my great affiliates. So check them out. Go to my website, journeyswithrebecca.com, and thank you for tuning in. Welcome tonight. It is my honor and pleasure to present to all of you my special guest. His name is Michael Tesarian, and we're going to be talking about one of his latest works, The Irish Origins of Civilization, The Servants of Truth, Druidic Traditions and Influences Explored. And a little bit later in the show will be Nancy Ogren on the full moon giving us an update on those great energies. And coming up on the Journeys with Rebecca Radio show next week is going to be Alex Jones in the End Times. And then in 2 weeks is going to be Athene Raphael, Finding Purpose in Spirit. And the following week will be Rose Tree. She's going to be talking about a very fascinating subject on our cloned beef. And so that's just some of what's coming up. Okay, back to our guest tonight, Michael Tesarian. You know, he's created many books. He's done video presentations and media events, some of which are Architects of Control, Psychic Vampirism, Atlantis, Time Gnosis, Terrascopes, oh my goodness, and the list goes on. But you can log on now to MichaelTesarian.com for more information on Michael. And our discussion tonight, I'm sure, will be extraordinary and enlightening. I hope to be able to give you, the audience, some time to ask some questions of Michael tonight. So I'm taking your emails, so please write me at mailbag@journeyswithrebecca.com. or I am from Yahoo, and the ID is Journeys with Rebecca, all one word. And if we do find we have time, I'll be giving out the phone number for later in the show. Now, the chat room is open, and you can find that by clicking on the front page of my website, and right there on the right side, there's a monitor in there, and they will be sending me any questions that you have so we can hopefully get those answered tonight. And we are talking to Michael tonight from Sweden, so hopefully the phone connections will be better than they were from last week from Mexico. This is going to be a great show, you guys, so stay with us. Let's journey together. We'll be right back. This is Rebecca Jernigan. You know, I've had some wonderful responses from people who have gotten personal private readings with me. Let me share some of them with you.
What can I tell you about my reading with Rebecca? Well, she took me on quite a journey. For me, Rebecca has brought in energies that have truly allowed me to see my path more clearly, along with allowing me to resonate with a much deeper understanding of my own mission and my own purpose.
Get your reading from me right now. I really would love to hear from you.
Schedule your private psychic reading with Rebecca, a truly gifted intuitive and clairvoyant. Call 1-888-958-2768. That's 1-888-958-2768. Where will your life's journey take you?
Check out Rebecca's website for the latest Journeys news and more. Log on to www.journeyswithrebecca.com.
All right, welcome back. And again, my guest tonight is Michael Tesarian. We're going to be talking about the Irish origins of civilization, the servants of truth, druidic traditions and influence explored. And welcome, Michael, to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rebecca. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Well, and I have to say thank you very much for staying up so late to be with us. I know it's in the middle of the night over there for you because you're in Sweden right now, correct?
Well, I'm traveling, yeah, and I'm staying with friends there. We are doing different projects together, so they're all in bed, and it's a perfect time to talk.
So you got kind of a little relaxing time here. Well, we hope that we continue to help you relax here tonight, Michael.
Well, not everybody that I, you know, when I travel, not everybody I actually do stay with is into what I'm doing, you know what I mean? And it's not good to, you know, I mean, I don't dialogue with people who are not receptive, and, you know, it's respectful just to not bother, you know, bringing it up. So, but they're kind enough to, you know, maybe stay at their place or whatever, and you know, they know me through other friends or whatever. So I don't want to compromise them, you know, so it's better to, you know, just
do what you do in your own space. That's great.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And if you can, if I sense that anyone's not really that into it, I never push it or, you know, get into it.
Well, yeah, and I think that should be true of everyone, Michael, no matter what we're talking about. Yeah, it's not our job, I don't think, for any individual to press upon somebody else their own way of belief, to kind of force or coerce somebody else to listen to that if they don't really want to.
Well, you know, my dad might have done that, but
well, I think
he was certainly a guy that fitted that description. He'd tell you what he believed, whether you liked it or you didn't.
Well, I think maybe that comes with being a dad. I don't know, unless he did that with everyone, you know.
Yeah, he did. And,
did he?
I'm somewhat, you know, I don't do that, especially when you're in a guest in somebody else's house. It's not a good idea to start beating him over the head with your own philosophy, you know.
No, probably not a good idea.
No.
Certainly not very nice anyway.
No, it's not.
Well, you know, I will tell you, I'm going to kind of start out a little bit, so Michael, you kind of know where I'm at too. I've watched your videos, you know, the ones on Atlantis and all the other ones. They're all over the place. You've done some marvelous works with educating people and giving different ideas and theories and thoughts, and you've really poured your heart and your soul into the work that you've done trying to bring this information forward. And obviously there's many people out there that don't agree, but more obviously to me is the ones that do, or that the information that you have to share resonates with them, and I can tell you that's true on my behalf. So it really is kind of a pleasure to have you on here, because I have not seen anything yet on any of your works that you've done on this Irish origins of civilization. And at first, I will tell you, is when I saw the topic, you know, the book, and I was like, well, I wonder what that's about. Well, in your introduction, which is absolutely phenomenally written, it not only does it explain things, but it does cause people to really stop and think about some of the things that you are saying. It, you know, you kind of have to let some of the things that you talk about sit with yourself and see where it takes you and leads you. So I'm really excited to have you on, because talking about this, because I don't know that anyone's ever quite talked about the Irish origins of civilization in such a manner as what you have, where you kind of tie it all in. So with, you know, all the other topics and subjects that you've done, such as Atlantis and all of that. So it's really, I'm really excited for you to kind of share with the audience a little bit about the Irish origins and also on how it kind of ties in with some of the other things that you've already been talking to us about.
Thanks, and it really, it does tie in. I mean, the work that a lot of people like myself are doing is primarily synthetic. It's not decompartmentalized in the way that academic subjects have been. And of course, people even within academia, you know, they lament the fact that there's so much specialization. And, you know, in the occult field or the metaphysical field or the research field, you know, we in alternative history, you know, there's no need to be so institutionalized, and so you can deal with a lot of what appears to be on paper very different types of subject matter. And to me, you know, it's about building bridges. It's about doing what the brain does. You know, the human brain creates synapses. You know, and we need, and knowledge also needs to be done that way. Subject study can be done that way. There's so many fascinating. For me, it's always about the fascinating crossovers and the fascinating, you know, juxtapositions and contrasts and comparisons that can be made, as opposed to just, you know, sort of being an expert in one field. You know, I think as we move forward in time, it's going to be more of this synthetic, syncretic knowledge that is going to be what's turning people on, you know.
And you know, I can tell you as you sat there and said that, I've had the pleasure of having many people on my show through these last 5 years that I've been doing Journeys with Rebecca Michael, and I've had people on very similar to what you're talking about. They're expert in one field, but when there's been times in some of the interviews where I've kind of stepped out of that realm a little bit because I was being taken for myself personally. The journey was being taken, you know, as kind of a parallel and more outside of the realm of their particular field. And they got pretty uncomfortable with that because, you know, so it's like, okay, so I had to draw the reins back in and only communicate with those guests that were able to comfortably talk about their area of expertise.
Yeah, this is so true. And I was brought up in a very formal, you know, or at least let's say in my schooling, you know, I saw all of this. You know, I wouldn't say my parents were like that too much, but certainly, you know, in the schooling it is terribly formal. It's very, very oppressive. You know, so again, you know, my mentors, my heroes, they tended to cover religion and politics and, you know, geology and, you know, I mean, anthropology and things that are just, you know, linguistics, things that are completely seemingly different disciplines, but they're not, you know. It's all about seeing the connections between things. And regarding the Irish origins, in fact, you know, I'm just so happy to have been able to do, finally put down in print something on the subject, because, you know, this subject has in fact been dealt with before, but it was dealt with by people whose names have largely been utterly forgotten, you know. And my main motive in writing this book was to sort of bring back their writings and their teachings and their philosophy. You know, I think it started, the very first person to really mention this was a lady actually called Anna Wilkes, who wrote in about 1890. You know, so over 100 years ago, and she was the first. And then very quickly after her came a guy called Conor McAdari. And again, I think Conor McAdari was actually based in America, even though he was, you know, his family was from Ireland. But coincidental to when he was writing, a very great man in America that all Americans should know about was also writing on the fact that possibly it's from the West, the Northwest, that the great cultures arose. And his name was he's the famous Ignatius Donnelly, a guy that, you know, should be a legend in alternative research. He was a great American writer, and he wrote two fantastic books, you see, on Atlantis. And he, almost at the same time as Conor McAdari, this is in the early 1900s, absolutely saw the evidence. And so he is, in a way, one of the first people. You know, so if people haven't heard of these different names, they'll find out about it in my book, because, you know, I mention these guys a lot and what they did. And then as we move up into history, then, you know, after Conor McAdari, then I guess it was almost 60 years you had to wait until 1960 when a guy from England called Commons Beaumont sort of picked up the same idea. And he was very, very maverick. I mean, he was an extremely, you know, independent thinker, very much along the lines of Immanuel Velikovsky. He was actually like the Immanuel Velikovsky before the Immanuel Velikovsky.
Ah.
Or let's say that they lived at the same time, but what happened was that McDowry's ideas, you know, preceded the printing of Velikovsky's ideas. And Velikovsky always used to say, sometimes in joking and sometimes in anger, that who the hell is this who is this Commons Beaumont that knows my own mind before I write it? You know? Well, he was this eccentric, you know, who was an amazing human being, and my work is very much dedicated to him. I have a whole chapter on Commons Beaumont. And he was a man that was so free-thinking and independent that he basically really, you know, took a like an atom bomb to all these different, you know, paradigms and sciences and just dropped it on it. And one of the most extreme things he said was that not only did all the elements of civilization originate in the Northwest, he claimed that most of the events, even physically, that are mentioned in the Bible, took place in Britain. Geographically, topographically. He was literally saying that all the things you read about, but in your mind, you've been mind-controlled into believing, happened in the Middle East, didn't, in fact, happen there. And so any descriptions of Jerusalem or the Temple of Herod or any of the Mount of Olives, you name it, if it's in the Bible, it's actually, those places originated in Britain. And his work, he actually could point to it. He could literally go to Jerusalem that's mentioned in the Bible and tell you where it was, you know, based on its orientations and descriptions and contours. whatever evidence was in the Bible for these places, he could say, I could physically take you, and I'll stick your head in it in Britain. And, of course, because he spoke like this, that was it. His books went nowhere. They were utterly suppressed, you know. And he was the subject of the Irish, or let's just say the British origins, the Western origins, you know, utterly faded from the scene. And we have what's taught in all the universities and schools of the world, which is the absolute opposite. That if there are such things as the elements of civilization, that means language, music, dance, basket weaving, you know, architecture, oh, you name it, you know, religion, all the different elements of religion, everything that contributes to civilization came into the West. We were a bunch of naked, spiritually destitute people, and it came from the Far East or from the East, you know. And this is utterly, utterly not true, you know.
Wow. I honestly, that's the first time I've ever heard that, and I'm just really blown away by that. I'm going to have to find some of his books. Are those books, are they available? I mean, can you still get them somewhere?
They are available. They weren't available for you know, many decades.
I'm sure.
They were only available in hardback to collectors, and they were
right.
Super expensive. Now they are available in facsimile form, but they're still very expensive. They're hard to get. They're out of print. But you can, if obviously if you work hard at something enough, you know, and search hard enough, you will be able to get
right.
it.
Right.
So Anna Wilkes's books are out there. If people go to my website, or...
Now, I've heard of her.
Yeah, if they contact me, you know, I can put them on to where to get these
okay.
Books. If but again, I cover most of their work in modern language because, you know, they wrote in a sort of an antiquated way, and it might be difficult for people to, it might be hard going,
Right.
So I've kind of, that's why I'm saying, that in many ways... It was what motivated me to write this book so that I could sort of, bring new life to their work and sort of restructure it and say, okay, let's update this and also put it into modern parlance so that people have no problem grasping what we're talking about here.
Right, because if you have to stop, it's kind of like, trying to stop and decipher what each word means. You kind of lose the
yeah.
whole context of
yeah.
the sentence and then the paragraph,
yeah.
and then you're just lost waiting around.
That's right. And remember, a lot of these people's work, hinged on rebutting scientific,
right.
So-called scientific paradigms. So a lot of it will be, if you don't know the whole background, you'll be just totally lost. Because when Collins Beaumont is maybe criticizing or critiquing, other scholars, other researchers, and if you're not familiar with what they originally said, well, then you're just going, what's he talking about? I'm lost here,
Right.
So it's a lot of background is required because these people had a passion to... bring great knowledge to people and to basically say that you're being lied to. There's a huge conspiracy here regarding history and regarding these elements of civilization. That's not to say that very important migrations and movements didn't happen from the East to West. They absolutely did, and we know that it did. But these are movements that were so much later in history. In fact, they're pretty much, post 1000 AD. They're what we would call into the historical era. They're, the ones that... I'm addressing where, maybe 10, 13,000 years B.C., then 6,000 years B.C., then 3,000 years B.C., then 600, B.C. We're
right.
talking about periods much earlier of these more Western movements. And then the subsequent return of the descendants of these people back. So then the historians come along and cunningly focus the light on these returns. That's the word that needs to be up on, Times Square, return. But they make those returns not look like returns. They make them look like the original migrations and movements and put them in the history books as such. And, of course, we're going to accept it because it looks legit. There is evidence for it. And nobody's going to question about, tell me what was happening thousands of years before these things, you see.
Well, and, that just makes absolutely perfect sense. I mean,
sure.
It's just like we know, like our Christopher Columbus in our books over here. Michael, I could never figure out why I was never all like gung-ho. Everybody just thought this Christopher Columbus, was, this great person. And I always, even as a young child, I was like, there's something not right here. Of course, we find out later, really what the truth was about his little journey over here, to try to find the Americas and what happened along the way. And I was like, okay. So, but that's not what they teach in the history books. There's so much that they teach our children that it's just so untrue. What makes us think that it hasn't been going on the whole time? It's not just in our
right.
modern history.
That's a great point, and it has been going on for a long time. History has been the most contaminated. Voltaire,
oh.
these people have all said that history is a very contaminated, warped thing. I mean, Columbus was not a great man. He was a very interesting man.
Right.
And he had a very hard life. After he came back from his discovery of America, he was completely disowned. He was ruined, you know.
Yep.
They took his knowledge and they left him flat so that his debtors could completely ruin him. You know, he was sickly. He was even in prison several times.
Right.
He was treated like a barbarian. He was treated in a very barbaric way. And, you know, he was just a tool, a puppet.
Yep.
Of these people who, you know, wanted to go and seize this gold and seize, you know, because they already knew about America. He was not the first discoverer of it.
Absolutely.
These people have hidden knowledge for years about, you know, the kinds of races and tribes that they knew lived over in those countries. And, you know, it's been shown that even Vikings, you know, were there first and so forth and so on.
Right.
And I really rest a lot of my work on the American Barry Fell, who is one of the experts showing that the Gaelic language, the
right.
Gaelic Ogham, you know, is in the petroglyphs of many of the states of America, particularly in the eastern, you know, Virginia and these
mm-hmm.
places and so many other states. And they came along and said that he was mad, you know, and that no such thing happened. And yet the Native American Indians in many of these states themselves say, yes, it was Pahona, it was the white, you know, white men with the long hair and et cetera that
right.
came, you know, here and taught us how to build and do these things. It's been proven that the Algonquin language is so kindred to Gaelic. The words practically mean exactly the same thing in both languages. There is evidence there, but, you know, it's been suppressed and it's been damaged and it's been contorted. And mostly, you see, people are very threatened by any knowledge that upsets the official official version of history.
Yeah, because then they have to go back and rewrite it, don't they? Or say, oops, we were wrong.
Or even tear it up, exactly.
Yeah.
Even tear it up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and they really don't. I guess we're going to say that the powers that have always been just really don't want to have to change any of that. They don't want to have to do that, because then that means that people are getting knowledge and they're slipping from their grasp of control and
That's right.
of putting the wool over their eyes. And it's very difficult for those that have always done this to accept that. And that's what they're fighting very hard, is that we do not have our knowledge. Our knowledge has always been kept separate from us. And I think you've talked a lot about that in some of the works that you have done, even prior to the Irish origins here in this book. So you've talked a great deal about that, and I would have to tell you I so agree with that. I think we need to take just a really short break, but when we come back, Mike, I'm going to let you just go ahead. We're going to get some more into the Irish origins of civilization. You guys don't go away. We're going to be right back. Hi, this is Rebecca Jernigan. You know, sometimes my schedule does not always allow for me to get to all the inquiries to have a reading. And sometimes I just can't get to everyone as quick as they would need answers. Well, now I have a solution. I am teaming up with my colleagues at the American Association of Professional Psychics. They are there 7 days a week with a very special group of experienced professional psychics. And they have been offering quality psychic readings by phone since 1989. You know, I also know that by using American Association of Professional Psychics, you can be sure the psychic you connect with has been tested and certified for ethics, professionalism, and proven psychic ability. So call now or anytime, 1-800-717-7887. It's still just $3.99 per minute using a major credit card or debit card. But it does get better. Here's a special offer. If you purchase time for a psychic reading from their website, you'll get a 50% discount. Go to certifiedpsychics.com. Take advantage of the savings. Readings are regularly $3.99 per minute. Why not get 50% off? And that web address is certifiedpsychics.com, or just click on the banner from my front page. So go ahead, call today, 1-800-717-7887, American Association of Professional Psychics.
Fate Magazine, providing true reports of the strange and unknown. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, life after death, and much, much more. To receive your free issue of Fate Magazine, call now, 800-728-2730. Or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Hello, I'm Jane Goodall, only half of the world's forests and wetlands that existed at the start of the 20th century still exist today. We must do a far better job of protecting wildlife habitats, or environmental chaos awaits those who follow us. If you own land you want kept safe forever, the Wildlife Land Trust can help. Call 1-800-729-SAVE. 1-800-729-SAVE.
More than talk, it's entertaining insight and discoveries. You're listening to Journeys with Rebecca.
All right, welcome back. We are talking with Michael Tessarian, The Irish Origins of Civilization, The Servants of Truth, Druidic Traditions and Influence Explored. And Michael, I can tell you, during the break, I was in kind of looking at the chat room, and boy, I tell you, we've got people just chatting in there. They're having fun. They're expressing their ideas, and this is what it's about. This is really great. Causes people to think, causes them to be able to communicate with other people of like minds, and so this is just a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is. It really is.
Now, normally I wouldn't do this, Michael, but there's somebody that just had a comment that I wanted to read before we got into the rest of it that instant messaged us. And it said, your work must be made a part of the standard university curriculum. Thinking outside the box, looking at the real truth. Thank you for your research. And it's from a gentleman by the name of Matt in Omaha.
Oh, that's nice of him to say that.
Well, and I'm not sure, Michael, if honestly that we, you know, if more and more people start doing the kind of work that you're doing and spreading these things and really getting this truth out there, that we really can make a difference and we really can start changing these things. And for people to stand up and say, you know what, I'm not going to accept this anymore. You can take your mind control stuff and your lies and your control mechanisms and move on out, because that's not what we're about.
And that is happening. Once people start to realize that these individuals...
Are you still with me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, there you are.
When people realize, because what you said is absolutely right, when people start to realize that the reason why these architects of control are becoming more draconian every day, why they're taking more and more people's rights away, or trying to, is precisely articulated to the point that you've made, which is that people are waking up. If you know, so I don't look at it pessimistically. I also don't really believe that it's a case of that people are asleep. It's that they've never been awakened before.
Ah, there's an idea for you.
This, you see, because if you say that somebody's asleep, it almost implies that they were awake at one time, then they went to sleep, and now need to be reawakened.
That's true.
But historically speaking, this is not the case. We are the very first generation, the very first era of people, the first demographic to have internet, to have unlimited access to books and to information, you see, mm-hmm. be able to be literate and to be free in our minds enough, you see. It's a very recent thing to be even ideologically and mentally free to be able to question what we know. It's an absolutely, unique moment in history, and this is what I think the architects of control are actually very frightened about, is that they cannot help but see that their tyranny, their age-old control might in fact be slowly eroding away, and that's why they become a little bit more, not a little bit more, but a lot more invasive and a lot more belligerent, as we've seen that they are now again becoming. Not that they need much they don't need much
help.
Help to do that, yeah, because these people are literally psychotic. But it goes in waves. Sometimes they have relative prosperity and relative freedom, and then sometimes they become again highly oppressive, and they're becoming oppressive again, and they're becoming consensus orientated again, because I believe they're threatened by the fact that there is a new energy in the world, and people are mad as hell, and they're not just going to take it anymore, and that is exactly what's happening right now.
And I have to agree with that. And I know there's people out there, they want me to make this one statement. The statement would be that there's many people that stood at some point in their time of their life, and they stood and they looked at their life and they said, gosh, something just doesn't feel right. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it seems like just something is out of sync. And that's what causes people to start looking for different answers, different ideas, different thoughts. And then that's how kindred spirits, so to speak, come together. And the more that we do this, the more energy we give it and the more knowledge we uncover.
That's right, absolutely. And it's very important in the American psyche to tap into that, because ultimately that's a pioneer spirit again. It's just that this time it's changing and it's moving into the realm of knowledge and history, because too many Americans turned off their historical interest, and you know, they have this amnesia now, thinking, you know, and again, it was partly understandable that you know, they would want to forget the horrors that their forefathers and they themselves had to experience while in the old world, so to speak. And coming to America, you know, it's just so much energy needed to go into, you know, conquering the land and making new homes, that unfortunately the downside of that was that people turned off their, you know, interest in history, and that left them wide open to attack.
Okay.
And we're seeing the consequences of that historical amnesia right now. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that things can't change again. All that needs to happen in an American context is that, again, this old or so-called ancient history, you know, history of Europe and a history of these oppressors needs again to be studied by people, by intelligent people. And then, you know, the right method of dealing with them will come about. But it can't come about from emotional convictions, you see, or, you know, a subjective understanding. It has to come from a very, very objective and clear, you know, precise discovery of exactly who is this enemy. Because if you don't know who the real enemy is, the ones at the top of the pyramid of power, then you're likely to waste all your time and energy, you see, you know, bashing those who are really not your enemy.
Right. That they're just caught up in it like everyone else,
exactly.
Or like many other else are.
Exactly. And of course, we see that going on today. And we see these politicians exploiting that, exploiting these differences, exploiting people's, you know, prejudices and what have you.
Exactly. Well, let's get back to your book for just a minute. Now, first of all, this is a two-volume book on your Irish origins of civilization. What prompted you to do two volumes? I mean, is there that much information in there that you had to do it, or is it like two separate parts? Or
The information does divide into two parts, and also I wanted to avoid doing it in one volume for simple practical reasons. One volume is very heavy.
Okay.
It's difficult for people to, you know, carry around. You know, and it's very hard to hold when you're reading it and things like this. And it's just like a big brick, you know. I mean, you could just use it to prop up a table or something like that, or, you know.
Well, one would hope, no, one wouldn't do that with your book, but.
You know, you could beat a burglar over the head with it or something like that, you know. It's just, I find holding a big book myself, you know, very uncomfortable. And so I wanted to make it into two volumes so it was easier to mail, and also, you know, just not a huge brick. And in fact, it would be much larger, actually, because the appendices of the book is not in the book. They're online. You know, the thing would be over 2,000 pages. It's already 1,100 pages.
Wow.
With about 550 pictures.
Okay.
But it would have been over 2,000 pages, you know, thick, had we added the appendices. So, again, thanks for the Internet. I was able to put the appendices for free on the website. So anyone who wants to go to the Irish Origins of Civilization website, they can read the appendices. We have excerpts of the different chapters, you know, so
yes,
that they can get their head around what this is all about, you know, before they make their final purchase. I mean, you know, because this is a book that I've often said is not for everybody. It's certainly not for everybody. It's not for those who are going to be threatened by, you know, the truth of the matter. Anyone who's still, you know, in a consensus trance is going to be very threatened by this book, because my work tends to be quite controversial, you know, and I kind of always put that warning on there that this is a book for people who are sick and tired of the lies. But more than just having teachers and great scholars who keep on telling you what the fallacies are, it's more important to start saying, okay, well, let's balance up by telling you also what the truth was. What were the facts? It's no good to just keep on, you know, pointing out error in life, or error in this and folly in that. You better, you know, start saying, well, let me reconstruct for you what the picture, the real picture, really is. Yeah.
And I think that's actually probably the reason why I like what you do the most, is because you not only point out what's wrong, but you also point out where to find the truth.
Yeah, this is very crucial, because a lot of people leave that out.
Yes.
And therefore they leave you in a void. you know, because I read a lot of books, and they used to do that to me. You know, I'd read a book and thinking, this is fantastic, you know, and my God, look how excellent deconstruction. I feel so much, you know, refreshed after that. But after you start to see, you suddenly realize there's a constructive and deconstructive, you know, model. It's brilliant to be able to deconstruct lies and to critique things. But then you also need to say, okay, now that we've removed this from the board, what can we put in this place? What existed here prior to these lies, you know, all of this network of lies, this labyrinth of fallacy and deception? What actually stood here once upon a time, you know, that was pristine? Can we get a handle on what that is? Now, of course, that will entail for a lot of people the realization that our history did not start 10,000 years ago or 7,000 years ago or whenever the history books say it did. The creation did not happen to be in creation just 4,000 years B.C., which is utterly preposterous, you know. So, you know, and yet remember, these were accepted for hundreds of years as being absolutely irrefutable truths.
Yes, I know. And then, yeah. You know, here recently, you know, they found all these archaeological finds of all these different things all across the world. Doesn't matter. You just everywhere. And, you know, these bones and these structures and these places. And they're going, oh, well, but it's much older than what we previously thought, you know, because too many people knew about it. You know, it's like they couldn't just, you know, say it was belonged to something because there was just too many people involved in these finds, and so the truth on some of these finds have come out. So of course, you know, scientifically speaking, they have to they kind of make light of all of that, you know, and they say, well, it was this or it was that, you know, they kind of relabel the things that have already been in existence, and they relabel them as something else, like pre this or pre that.
And that's right.
In fact,
and they literally mess around with the dates.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, and the so-called infallible science of radiocarbon dating. I mean, it's all refutable, you know.
Yes.
And these people have played a big number with misdating and misspeaking and misinterpreting, especially when it comes to quote-unquote Celtic history or when it comes to Egyptian, you know, history. I mean, the lies are unbelievable, the amount of false information and cover-ups and even assassinations that have been done in order to, you know, hide these few secrets. They're very important secrets, you see.
Oh, they are. They're extraordinarily important. They're important. That's why they've been so heavily guarded, because they only felt like the few elitist or whatever category you want to put them in was privileged to have this information. So, and that's interesting. I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you is that, you know, I looked at this whole carbon dating thing, and, you know, I looked at when it was actually you know, brought out, and they used it to, you know, start carbon dating anything. I was like, oh my God, how many years ago it was? I know our technology is way beyond that, and they're still using carbon dating, you know, to try to figure out when an artifact was there. I was like, that's
yeah,
just
and it's mostly
preposterous.
Wrong. It's been wrong so many times, but of course they don't want to let you know that. So they, you know, they don't. It's very, you know, it's hard to come across the evidence, but there is a mounting evidence. I mean, if people want to go and really see the evidence, they should pick up a book by a guy called Richard Milton called Shattering the Myths of Darwinism.
Yes.
In which he specifically has a whole chapter on this fallacy of the radiocarbon dating. Also is a book called The Chariots Still Crash. Name of the author escapes me for this moment, but the book is called The Chariots Still Crash, and that's a very good book. Again, you know, it shows that lots of you know, radiocarbon dating experiments that were done specifically in Hawaii,
yes,
you know, clearly prove the monstrosity of the lie of that, because, you know, the guy got a couple of examples, and I actually do mention this book and these examples in one of my DVDs. I think it's the DVD on Atlantis. I go into that, into this book, and to show that, you know, it's not very reliable, this carbon dating stuff. But it served those people who wanted to, you know, make a lot of these structures look a lot younger than they really were, you know?
Oh, absolutely, because then it fits into the whole history.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, then they can make the books fit. And, you know,
well, it's very, very, very important that lies have been told about the Egyptian culture. You know, about 60-70% of what we've been told about the Egypt is utterly, you know, fallacious, totally full of deception, particularly about the so-called pre-dynastic period.
Yes.
First of all, it's pretty ridiculous to even talk about a pre-dynastic period, you know, because that to do that means that you associate, you know, the dynasties only going back to about 3,000 years B.C., and that's already been shot to pieces, because people know that the dynasties actually stretched, you know, much further back than that.
Yeah, that's just what I was saying about they just label it pre-everything, right? We're just going to pre this and pre that so that it fits in with, you know, how they've already worded it and already presented it.
And that's what made me think of that, you know, particular anecdote when you said that, because this is a classic case in point that these people just come along and arbitrarily stick a date on, you know, a particular time, and all those fascinating dynasties before, you know, are considered pre-dynastic. In other words, not as important, or we don't have as much evidence, etc. Yeah, of course you don't have as much evidence because you flood the dam, like Aswan Dam, you bury all the things you discover, you hide them away, you loot all of these different temples in order to make sure that people, you know, don't have the evidence to prove certain very interesting things about ancient Egypt, because you stand to lose the whole network of your control should people realize that everything you've been teaching us is actually the reverse is true, you see.
Absolutely. Well, I want to give everyone your website again. It's michaeltessarian.com. And, Michael, we're going to come back and we're going to talk some more about the Irish civilizations. And you guys do not go away. We've got a lot more with Michael Tessarian coming up right after the break.
Sure to check out Mark Kerr's debut CD, One Drink Away from the Blues, at www.cdbaby.com. This flawless debut performance earned Mark an induction into the Blues Hall of Fame as Ambassador to the Blues for the state of Louisiana. Also, it earned him a nomination for a Musician of the Year in 2006 by the Academy of Texas Music. Mark Kerr, One Drink Away from the Blues, at www.cdbaby.com.
How would you like to lose weight without pills, chemicals, or watching your food intake, and a product that works with your body naturally to lose the weight you want? And all of this for under $75? Well, it's here, and it's a simple patch that attaches to your body and delivers pure energetic frequencies that your body recognizes and absorbs. This technology uses pure frequency energy, which maximizes the full potential for a body to effectively suppress hunger, burn fat, and create an overall feeling of well-being. The Form Weight Management Patch is charged with 34 different energetic frequencies lasting up to 3 days and are delivered through the 12 energetic pathways or meridians to the rest of the body. Check it out. Log on now to www.journeyswithrebecca.myfti.biz or click on the banner links found throughout my website.
Talk with an intuitive touch. Journeys with Rebecca.
All right, welcome back. We're here with Michael Tessarian talking about the Irish origins of civilization, servants of truth. Michael, I got a couple questions for you. Of course, you know, I'm looking at your website, and that's michaeltessarian.com, or actually I'm actually at irishoriginsofcivilization.com. And in the introduction, you have a couple of terms there that I thought maybe we could talk about briefly. One of them is the term Aryan, if I'm pronouncing that right, and the second one is Celtic.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I would love to talk about those because I hear a lot of people talking about those terms and really love for us to kind of broach this subject with the audience tonight.
Oh, absolutely, and you did pronounce them correctly. The word Ireland, you see, the word Ireland is spelt nowadays with an I. But in ancient days, it wasn't spelt with an I, it was spelt with an A, a capital letter A. So Ireland is actually the land, not of Ire, but of Aria, or the Ari, A-R-I. And it's also interchangeable with E, because in ancient Gaelic, the goddess that was one of the most important goddesses of the ancient Druids was called Ari, or Eri.
Right.
And in fact, we find the word, her name, she was an earth goddess, you see, And we find her name in the very Latin today, terra, which means the earth.
Uh-huh.
You know, like terra firma, etc.
Right.
Or terrestrial or whatever. So terra, you take the T away, you have Eri or Era. This is, you know, the land of Ireland's name. And this, one of the other important connotations of the goddess's name was, that, you know, it comes down to us as the Aria, meaning the pure ones, the ones in the service of the goddess, or the ones in the service of the earth. And so there's nothing racial about it. It's just, the racial thing is more of a secondary or third sort of permutation of the word. The word ultimately represented an elite. It represented a caste of elders. And it's very important to bring this out, that it represented caste more than it did race. The idea being that a man from any race could ultimately qualify as an Arya if he had bothered his ass to do his homework. In other words, you know, if he strove after truth, if he strove after the knowledge of the flora and the fauna, and if he attended to the duties, you know, in a ritualistic manner, and he had purified himself sufficiently, then basically he was an Arya.
Okay.
But the original Arya, where the word actually comes from, is just literally was the ancient name of Ireland. I mean, there's no more mystery to it than that. And it subsequently represented, it actually represented the name of the goddess, or those in her employ. And how it got to other parts of the world, you know, is its own intriguing story. And, of course, the main answer to that is that the Arya themselves took it there. The Arya literally were not just confined to Britain or to Ireland. This was a worldwide network of the Arya. And these Arya were referred to under different names in different places. And that's why you can see a lot of the word A-R-I, Ari, or Eri. You see, you'll find this term in a lot of other places where you might not first, you know, expect it, like Iran, right? The word Iran, you see? Or in the Bible, in characters like Joseph of Arimathea, you know?
Uh-huh.
So we've got all of these different, you know, etymological phenomena proving what I'm talking about, which is the history of words, the place names, all sorts of, you know, names of rivers that turn up. It's these old Gaelic Irish gods and goddesses, you see, that their name is turning up elsewhere.
So actually, people should be using the term Gaelic and not Celtic?
Well, a Gaelic person is a Celtic person, although Gaelic is a word that also now refers to the language of Ireland.
Right.
You know, when they're talking about the language, they say Gaelic. But say that for a moment that you realize that the word Gaelic really represents a branch of the Celtic people.
Okay.
Right? That's what most official, and I'm talking purely officially here. Officially, the Gaels were a very, very prestigious and highly, you know, adept, highly interesting group of Celtic, quote-unquote, people that arrived in Ireland, you know, they say, from the West, meaning from Europe, you know, from the East, actually, from Europe. And there's different, you know, philosophies about where, different ideas about where these Gaelic people came. The most commonly held belief is that the Gaels arrived in Ireland about 600 B.C., and that they came from Spain. But those who have really done their homework knows that they, before they went to Spain, they actually were what's called Scythians from the you know, steppes of Ukraine. They're more like where Russia, modern Russia, is now, moving over towards Turkey. There was a very, very important, you see, quote-unquote Celtic group that lived there, and it's these individuals who make up what we would call the Gaelic people, who, you know, came to Ireland about 600 B.C.,
And, you know, it's interesting you brought that up, because years and years ago, when I was doing a lot of research on Celtic and Nordic and you know, all of that kind of in that whole genre thing, it seemed like that there was so many things that led me back to that area of what is now modern Siberia or Russia, and where a lot of things seem to originate, at least in the point of where I was the referencing of that point. So I think that's really fascinating. I mean, it kind of confuses somebody if they're not sure where to go from there, which is what it did to me, because I was like, okay, so now where do I go with this?
And well, it's going to be confusing because so many lies have been told about these Gaels and Scythians. See, the word Celtic is an utterly pretty much a useless word. It doesn't describe anything, as a matter of fact. It was actually a prejudicial term that was used by the Romans to describe anyone who basically they decided was a barbarian. So the Roman historians used it to denotate far too many people who in their own caste or race were a little bit too different. So the word Celtic could be used for Germanic people, it could even be used for some Nordic people, it was certainly used to describe Spanish people, it was used in certain French groups, and then it was bunged on, you know, the people of Ireland and England without any real logic to do that at all. And so then those scholars who still exist today or who've been writing books in the last 50 to 100 years, who haven't researched that, who haven't even looked into the meaning of the word Celtic or found out where this word even comes from, are then going to just regurgitate the same folly, you see, thinking that it's scientific fact. And so, you know, I have not made that mistake. I refute the term Celtic because it's not a good term to use. It makes things much more confusing. And my book goes into showing people who are even remotely interested in these subjects of the movement of races or the different tribes that lived in Europe and also in Britain, who these people really were. And I try to categorize them in a more logical and clear way, you know, after the 25 years of research I've done, which has helped me to expose that there's been a massive campaign of disinformation released about these terms like Gaelic and Celtic and Druidic and Aria, you know, and we need to restore these words because when they're put back into their pristine, unadulterated, you know, form, my God, history comes alive. You start to understand what is going on here. You know, the Greeks, you ask anybody who studied Greek mythology, you know, about the supreme goddesses. You know, you have Hera and you have, you know, Juno. Hera is exactly the word era.
Right.
The capital H always used to represent the, or like you're putting the word the on the front of something.
Ah.
So Hera is actually the era, or the eri. I mean, the very same word is brought to Greece from these traveling people. And we understand about the Scythians, these people who inhabited northern Turkey, northwestern Turkey, and up into Scythia, which is a part of Russia, would have been a part of Russia. We understand that these people originally came from Britain during an age in which is called the Age of Catastrophe. And that means that about 13,000 years ago, when the earth was torn, you see, by these awful, awful devastations, that now finally the scientists and geologists are being forced to accept that these awful cataclysms took place, particularly in the Northwest, that Ignatius Donnelly had gone blue in the face talking about, that Commons Beaumont had put people's face in, but nobody accepted it. Now it's been accepted, you see. And Emmanuel Velikovsky wrote about this. So all these mavericks, now modern science is accepting that these ravages took place. Well, then it follows that just like the, you know, tsunami that took place over there in Indonesia, you don't just sit there sunning yourself when a tsunami has hit you.
No.
People in their millions, if necessary, will migrate. They will have to up and leave because that is what happens today when there is a massive cataclysm. You know, this is a visible thing that happens in today's world. Even if it's a man-made disaster or it's a martial law situation or if it's a volcano like they have in Hawaii, you know, or tsunamis or whatever, people don't just sit there and, you know, they leave en masse. Well, that Britain, England, as people know, is not very large. The whole of Ireland fits inside Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, a very, very important, enlightened people. But believe me, when the kind of devastations of 13,000 years ago rained down on Atlantis and rained down on these lands that are known in mythology, you see, as the places of the enlightened ones.
Right.
These people were forced to leave. And we have been told a pack of lies about Britain, and we've been forced to believe that there was no land bridges between Ireland and England, and England and Europe.
Right.
But in fact, these land bridges did exist. Ergo, it was actually quite possible for people to come and go to what we now know to be Britain. But when the waters have, you know, started to rise, and they finished rising about 3000 BC, then of course these land bridges were sunk under the waves, and also many of the villages and towns and other remarkable structures are now beneath the waves all over Britain and Scandinavia, and it's beneath the waves in the mud. And so to this very day, people don't realize that whole cities and whole towns and whole landmarks are sunk beneath the waves of a rising ocean. And more importantly, that these land bridges, which once existed in ancient times that people could cross, that is exactly the way that these originally Western people, who even go back to Atlantis, but who then had reestablished themselves, you see, in Britain, when they were then continually ravaged by these awful famines and disasters, they made their way into Europe. And so the people that then appear later on, like I said earlier in our show, in our interview, the people who then appear to be Scythians, who appear to be Pelasgians, who appear to be Dorians, who appear to be all of these, you know, ancient forefathers, are in fact transplanted from the Nordic and British countries, and it's their descendants, you know, 1,000 years later or 5,000 years later, who start making the trek back to Britain. But historians of our age can come along and do the, you know, famous, the famous magical lantern trick to make you think that those returning migrations are the original migrations.
Yes, yes,
and that
yes.
The symbol of the harp and the symbol of the red hand and the symbol of the lion, you see, and you look on the Scottish flags and see the dragon, right? And all of these various symbols that are found on the houses of the Western nobility or that are on the flags and the cities, we're told all of that, those symbols. And I go into this page after page, you know, talking about this symbolism that we find all over the northwestern countries in later days. We're told to believe that a lot of that came from, you see, the East. And this is a complete and utter lie, because it got to the East first by way of the West. These were originally Western symbols that, you know, went migrated out and then came back. And this is the piece that it needs to be understood. So, you know, yes, it turns out that, you know, right now, I am one of the first people to be bringing this up, and I hope that my work, you know, I've always seen my work as not the final word on this by any means, but that this will kickstart a subject that needs a progress report, you know, every so often, because every week that goes by, we're finding new information about this, you know, what I've called the Irish origins of civilization. So when I'm talking about Ireland in the book, or when Ireland is in the title of the book, it's not the Ireland people think of today when they normally think of Ireland, you see, so they go, okay, what's this stuff about the Irish? The very first thing to understand is it's not about the Irish that anyone knows about who's heard that term.
Exactly. Well, we have got to take a break, but you guys, if you have questions for Michael, we're going to be coming back in the second hour. Please feel free to mailbag at journeyswithrebecca.com, or you can IM me at Yahoo at journeyswithrebecca, all one word. You guys, don't go away. Michael, don't go away. We're going to be right back. Hi, this is Rebecca Jernigan. I would like to share with you some information about my friends and colleagues at the American Association of Professional Psychics. Here are their founding principles to uplift the public image of professional psychics. Distinction through ethics, professionalism, and credibility. To provide positive press and publicity for certified psychics. To provide assurance that certified psychics are authentic, ethical, and professional. So please check them out, certifiedpsychic.com, or call 1-800-717-7887. Again, that's 800-717-7887. You'll be glad you did.
For 58 years, Fate has provided true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine, containing articles by experts in all walks of life and by others just like you who have something dramatic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on all aspects of the paranormal, angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now 800-728-2730. Or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
¶¶